Hi, I'm Dr. Howard Zucker, the doc in docology. I first met David Kessler the night before my Hopkins pediatric internship began. He was a graduating senior resident at the time. And even then, it was clear he wasn't just going to practice medicine, he was going to change systems. See, during my internship, we needed an experimental drug from across the country. And I asked people, how do I get it? And someone said, well, when David Kessler was here, he just called Washington, FDA, DOT, DOD, Department of Defense, whatever it took. And I said, wait, as a pediatric resident, I can do that? And the response was, no, David Kessler could, you cannot. And that tells you pretty much everything about Dr. Kessler. He thinks big, he moves institutions, and he changes public policy. And now, decades later, he's back with a new book, Diet, Drugs, and Dopamine. It's about more than just obesity. It's about how our brains and our cravings, for that matter, have been quietly rewired by modern life. Dr. Kessler served as the FDA commissioner under Presidents George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. He was on the COVID response team under President Biden. And he's served in the past as the dean at Yale Medical School and at the University of California, San Francisco. I've known David for over 40 years. That's a long time. And he's as passionate about medicine and public health now as he was when we first met. So it's a pleasure to have him. Welcome to the podcast. I am thrilled to have you here today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. You've written several books on nutrition and obesity. And I was wondering why, if you could tell us a little bit why you wrote this book at this particular time.
You mentioned COVID. An intense period of time for all of us. I had the opportunity, you know, to co-lead Operation Warp Speed. At the end of it, I found myself, you know, these 18-hour days, 7 days a week. You were instrumental, Howard, in you know, getting us to the other side. You know, we live 676 million vaccines within 5 miles of everyone free, I don't think we realize what COVID really did to us and the intensity of that period. But I ended up some 40 pounds heavier, didn't like myself, and sort of wanted to tackle this mystery of weight and understand why over my lifetime I've gained and lost my body weight repeatedly, but every time I lost it, I gained it back. So, you know, I really wanted to understand what was going on.
And it's just it's an urgent issue today, right? Because you've taken on critical issues, whether tobacco, COVID, as you just mentioned, obesity. How is the food system, the food industry, basically hijacking the brain's reward systems in many ways? What can people do about that?
Yeah. So before we get to that,
sure.
Before we get to, and you're absolutely right, right, that these ultra formulated foods are addictive. But let's just talk about this question about weight, right? Because the problem is not weight. I mean, it's not how big you are or small you are. To me, the question is, and this is really a question of health, the question is one of what concerns me is this toxic fat, this fat that accumulates in our midsection, that gets into our liver, our pancreas, I mean, into our muscle, into our heart, and it causes metabolic chaos. And we all knew that weight wasn't good for us, but we didn't realize that this toxic fat was causative, that it was causal on the continuum of cardiac, kidney, metabolic diseases, certain forms of cancer, and even potentially neurodegenerative diseases. So we have this, you know, the fact that only 12.2% of the American public are metabolically healthy, and this toxic fat is the reason. And if you now go back to what's driving that accumulation of toxic fat over the last 4 decades plus, I think you get to the fact that it's these, what I call these ultra formulated foods. And there's, you know, these foods, I use the word ultra formulated. Some use the term ultra processed, but I consider them highly palatable, energy dense, I mean, highly processed foods. It's that perfect trifecta of fat, sugar, and salt. The reason I stay away from processed is processed, people tend to think about preservatives and emulsifiers and stabilizers. And to me, it's fat and sugar, fat and salt, fat, sugar, and salt. And we put it on every corner, made it available 24/7, made it socially acceptable to eat anytime. We're living in a food carnival. And the fact is, you know, these foods trigger the reward centers of the brain.
And two things. One is on the toxic fat. You mentioned in your book that all of these different diseases that people have, some of these chronic diseases, the percentage increase of how much people can actually end up with some of those chronic diseases has magnified multiple fold as a result of some of this toxic fat around the organs that do different things that can cause illness. So whether it's the adrenal glands or the heart or the liver, as you mentioned, I want to ask you about that, but also the ultra processed versus ultra formulated. Aren't all the foods in the supermarket, I mean, you walk down the shelves, it's all like ultra formulated food on these shelves. You could, the cereals, where are there, besides the fruits and vegetables, where else can you find foods that are not ultra-formulated?
Well, I mean, you're right. I mean, the enemy, the culprit is not food. The real culprit is these ultra-formulated foods, whereby the structure of the foods, you know, was eliminated. I mean, this ultra-formulated foods, they took those components, these fat, sugar, and salt, again, in which these combinations of fat and, you know, fat and salt, and fat, sugar, and salt stimulate the reward centers. And they concentrated those, took everything else out that slowed down eating. So you have not only these reward circuits being triggered, which get us to eat more and more, but you also have this rapidly absorbable, both glucose and fructose, that overwhelm the metabolic circuits that I think, you know, feed into this, you know, this term hyperinsulinemia. Now, whether this toxic fat, this visceral adiposity occurs first and that produces this elevated hyperinsulin levels, or whether the hyperinsulinemia causes, you know, this visceral adiposity, it happens so fast that it's hard to know which one causes which, but you end up in this vicious cycle. But these ultra formulated foods, and in that case, these foods that, you know, have just result in rapid rises, it's all about the pharmacokinetics, you know, and we're overwhelming, you know, both those glucose spikes result in elevated, you know, insulin levels, this visceral adiposity. So you get caught in this metabolic chaos, and that also certainly favors continued fat storage and this leak of free fatty acids that's, you know, causing this ectopic fat to accumulate in where it shouldn't be in these vital organs.
Well, are some people more prone to this? Are some people just have more of an addiction to some of this food, and you know, how much of this is nature? How much of this is sort of nurture when we address this kind of a problem?
So let's redefine, let's make sure we understand what we mean by addiction. Addiction is not about the weak. It's not about the downtrodden. I mean, these circuits, you know, exist in all of us. If you go back thousands of years, we lived in an environment of scarcity. Our brains evolved to be able to find the most energy-dense foods. It's not that our brains are not working well. If anything, they're working only too well, because now we put these energy-dense foods on every corner and our brains are just being triggered. What are the essential elements of addiction? I see three. This cue-induced wanting, right? I get triggered. I have these thoughts of wanting. If I try to resist, I have craving, right? And then what dawned on me is every time I lost weight, I mean, I was sure to gain it back. You know, why did I always relapse, right? I mean, and in the end, those addictive circuits are there. We don't change our food environment. We don't change our relationship with food. Those addictive circuits, that power of food, I mean, for many of us, you know, this pull of food is very real. Now, we're all different. We're all wired to focus on the most salient stimuli. What interests me is not the people who have struggled with their weight. It's people who don't get what we're talking about. Those are the ones I want. What are they captured by? What are their circuits wired for? Is they just don't respond, or is just that other things are salient to them? And so what we have is this mystery of weight. I mean, at the core are these ultra-formulated foods, right? And these ultra-formulated foods are addictive. And now we have these drugs that come along that can tamp down that addiction, right? But the ultimate solution, right, I mean, is to deal with these ultra-formulated foods.
So there's two parts. One is that industry, we have to address the industry perspective of this. And then we have to also address sort of what people can do in their own lives to sort of try to control how much their own intake is. And perhaps
that's why I wrote this book. I wrote this book because, I mean, if we wait for the food industry to change the food environment, I mean, it's going to be a long time coming. And we don't have that time because only 12% of us are metabolically healthy. The American body is ill, and we need things to be able to protect ourselves and reclaim our health.
So on the industry side of this, and you took on big tobacco, and I'm sure 20, 30 years ago, people probably said it's going to be a tough job to take on the tobacco industry or the pharma industry. But now you have, for lack of a better phrase, big food. So the administration now, RFK Jr., is going to take on the food industry. How successful can he be in addressing these issues? And also from your experience of taking on big tobacco, what lessons could he learn from that to help achieve the goal of taking on the food industry?
One thing in Washington is you understand you have to get things right and right the first time. I think the focus on these ultra-formulated foods is right. I think the focus on chronic disease is right. But if you see where he's focused on things like food color dyes, on seed oils. However laudable that is, I mean, that's not really what's driving this problem. This problem is the reason the American body is ill is because of this toxic fat, this central adiposity, this visceral adiposity, this fat that's accumulating in our waste. And it's because of the energy dense, highly palatable, high glycemic foods. So, I mean, he has one chance to get this right. And I just don't think he's focused on the real culprit here.
So if we could switch, you could switch seats with him. He was on the podcast, which I'd love to have him on, and talking about whatever subjects he wanted to, but you were sitting as the secretary. What would be the way you would tackle this in an effort to try to address what you're talking about, ultra-processed foods?
Well, I mean, I think you have to give people the tools to be able to deal. Once you realize these are the addictive circuits, and these addictive circuits are not going away, you obviously have to change that food environment. And he can play a key role, but he's going to have to deal with fat, sugar, and salt. This is not about color dyes, right? I mean, again, those things are fine, but that's not the what's driving these food addictions. Now, the fact is that, how do you tamp down the circuits? And these new anti-obesity drugs are one tool. They're not a magic pill. They're not a panacea. But understand how they work. I mean, so you have the food addictive circuits on the one hand, driving intake. And what's powerful enough to overcome those food addictive circuits? So the way these drugs work in significant part is both on the gut and what's part, that part of the brain called the hindbrain that slows down gastric emptying. So food stays in your stomach longer. There is this spectrum, you know, this spectrum of feeling full, of satiety. Then there's Thanksgiving fullness, right? We go, and then I can take you, you know, if food stays in your stomach longer, I mean, I can take you to that edge of nausea and sometimes over that cliff into outright, you know, GI distress, right? So what these drugs do by triggering what the aversive circuits of the brain, right? I mean, these circuits were designed, you know, to deal with toxins in the gastrointestinal system. Food stays in your stomach longer. What don't you want to do when you have food staying in your stomach? You don't want to add more food to your stomach. So you condition yourselves not to want to eat as much, and in some cases eat a lot less. And what the companies learned to do, understanding the very early predecessor molecules of these GLP-1 drugs, when they gave them to laboratory animals, these animals didn't even move. I mean, they developed something called the term visceral malaise, right? I mean, the people just, because food stays in your stomach, you know, you're going to have this kind of distress. So these drugs take you to the edge of nausea, and you condition yourself. You say, oh, I don't want to put anything else in. You know, we've all experienced that. We've had the flu. Our GI tract shuts down. We don't want to lose our appetite. We have food poisoning. Food, you know, GI tract, you know, slows down. I can't put anything else in, or, you know, I'm going to be sick, right? We all have that sense of that feeling. And look, we're all different, and everybody perceives these drugs in a different way. But the companies have learned to titrate these drugs as far as dose to get to the point where they, you know, they slow down, they tamp down the addictive circuits. So you have, there's a diagram in the book of the seesaw. On the one hand, you have the addictive circuits, and on the other hand, you have these aversive circuits, and they are just basically, you know, they're conditioning you not to want to eat anymore.
So are you saying then that basically these drugs sort of jumpstart your efforts on weight loss, because that's one part, but then all the other things that one needs to do to address weight loss is obviously needs to be done as well.
Well, the companies would like you to just stay on these drugs for life, right? But the average data show that people are on these drugs for 8 to 9 months, then they're off it. They're too expensive. They're injectables. People don't want to just take drugs for their whole life to add to that drug burden, right? So what's going to happen if you're off these drugs? Only work. You only have this, you know, this sort of satiety, this edge of nausea while you're on these drugs. Go off these drugs, and people gain back the weight. So what's going to happen in 3-5 years? People will have taken this drug, spent thousands of dollars, lost the weight, gone off the drug, gained back the weight, and we're going to say, hey, this is one big failure. So one thing the FDA needs to do with the companies is to learn how to use these drugs in the real world. I mean, I think the most important thing is these are a very powerful tool. They have real adverse, you know, adverse events, right? They are not a cakewalk, but they can help you to change that, your relationship with food. But if you're not going to stay on these drugs for your whole life, then you have to use other tools and use a whole toolbox of nutritional support, behavioral change, physical activity, as well as drugs. Look, there shouldn't be any shame or stigma about using these drugs. Just because I don't have, you know, the hormones to my degree of satiety or fullness, I mean, it's not equivalent to yours. So getting help here, but you need a team. I mean, you know, bariatric surgery, go back, you know, 2-3 decades, was pretty dangerous until people figured out how to provide comprehensive support. In some ways, the weight loss associated with these drugs comes pretty close to that bariatric surgery. You know, the companies have not told people, you know, I mean, the data on how much people are eating when they're on this you know, many people are eating less than 1,000 calories. Some are eating 600, 800 calories a day. That's semi-starvation. That has to be done under good medical care. And again, you can use, while you're on these drugs, can you learn to change your relationship to that I don't want that ultra-formulated food. I don't want to put large portions in my stomach because I'm going to feel lousy. Can you condition yourself and change that relationship so that carries over when you're off these drugs? Or do we get the data to show that it's safe and effective to be able to go off these drugs, come back on these drugs if you need a little kickstart again? I mean, to take you to that edge of nausea, so you recondition yourself. We got to figure out how to use these drugs wisely.
Unpacking a few things you mentioned, because you touched upon the cost of the drugs. Medicare, Medicaid, is that going to be a challenge for people to be able to continue to use these drugs, not just for obesity, but also for diabetes? And how do we address that challenge?
So the Biden administration had agreed to propose to cover these drugs for weight loss. There's a provision in the statute says they can't be used for weight loss, but then they reinterpreted that to say, yes, but they can be used for obesity. And the current administration has not agreed to cover these drugs. So these drugs should be made available. They are important tools. Imagine struggling your whole life with these issues with weight. And now something comes along to help you deal. Again, it's not weight, it's about health. It's about cardiac disease, renal disease, diabetes, cancer. And there's something available. And, you know, I mean, it just shows you how broken the healthcare system is. What did we do? The companies charge excessively for these drugs. There is this thing under the Food and Drug Act that certain compounded drugs could be made, but those drugs come, you know, the source drugs, the API material, you know, is made in China. There are a lot of middlemen. You don't even know where that drug necessarily is coming from. FDA is not assured the safety. So people wanted access to these drugs, they couldn't afford the brand name drugs, so they had to resort to these drugs for whom the safety is, you know, could not be assured. Right now, the pharmaceutical companies are lowering their prices to compete with the compounded drugs. So you got something's wrong with that picture.
You mentioned in the book also about the AMA saying that there are many of these online GLP-1 sellers who operate illegally. You're touching upon that. And also the National Association of the Board of Pharmacy said there are tens of thousands of these online pharmacies that are illegal. So how does the public know who they should trust when they're getting?
You don't. I mean, it's the Wild West. I mean, you know, when you deal with these branded name drugs, again, and they're too expensive, they need to get the prices down. But when you, under the brand name drugs, at least there's something called a drug master file that gets filed. You know where it gets made. You know the quality assurance standards. There aren't even what I call reference standards, I mean, on these other drugs to test against. So you know what should be in the drug.
So what could the, you know, if you were the FDA commissioner today, what could you do to sort of make sure the public is safe regarding this issue?
You want to make sure the public has access to affordable quality drugs, right? So you have to, the administration has to get the price of these drugs down, but provide drugs for whom the safety has been assured, not drugs that are, you know, just you're playing roulette.
And I want to get back to the GLP-1s in a second, but with the FDA, so they I don't know if they've done this yet completely or not, but they were going to cut like 19 to 20% of the staff there. How do you achieve these goals if you don't have enough staff there? Or is there?
I mean, by the nature of your question, I think you've answered it.
You don't achieve the goals, you're saying.
Well, I mean, I had the privilege of doing Warp Speed. You can argue that it was Trump's greatest success in his first administration, Warp Speed, being able to get access and develop these vaccines and safe and effective vaccines in record time. But we were able to do that because we had the infrastructure that was built up over decades, not because we were smarter, because we were able to rely on that infrastructure. Now they're cutting that infrastructure. I don't get it.
I know, and that's a huge problem. It's a huge problem, not just at the FDA, but obviously the other agencies. And we both worked in government and know how important they are, the government is, to achieving the goals, to making sure what the public needs is achieved. On the, and I we'll get back to that in a second if we have time, on these GLP-1s, what I've read, and I've saw the New England Journal of Medicine article from 2023, which basically said that, you know, they studied 17,000 people in, what, 40, 41 countries. And they said it's these drugs protect you or help you or decrease the incidence of heart attacks or cardiac deaths. And I was wondering whether these drugs are the statins of the 2030s. You know, in the next 5-10 years, people will say, you need to be on this, just like you need to be on a statin to prevent a problem rather than cure a problem. So I was wondering what you thought about that.
So there are, when you look at what's causing that cardiac disease, there are, traditionally, we were focused on a lipid pattern of elevated LDL-C,
part cholesterol of medicines. Yeah, the cholesterol.
That was the bad cholesterol.
Yeah.
The LDL-C. And statins reduced those dramatically and have resulted in major improvement in cardiovascular disease. We also know that there is this lipid pattern of hypertriglyceridemia, these elevated triglycerides, these non-HDL particles, this pro-inflammatory state that results from this visceral adiposity. I mean, I am pretty convinced that the reduction in cardiac events is in part because of a reduction in this visceral adiposity, this toxic fat, this inflammatory milieu. This is ever as possible it's resulting in this cardiac disease. So I think you have, this visceral adiposity, this toxic fat, this ectopic fat. I mean, really is in the causal chain. But I think, in the end, you want to get your LDL-C down. I mean, that still, I think, drives, a good deal of atherosclerosis. You could do that with statins, but there's these other blood lipid patterns and this inflammatory state that the GLP-1 drugs reduce by reducing this toxic fat.
So basically, the toxic fat, if you have a lot of fat around the muscle's you're not gonna be able to run as well. If you have a lot of fat around your pancreas is not gonna do its job. The adrenal glands aren't gonna do there, the liver, the heart.
I mean, it really causes this release of free fatty acids, increase in inflammatory molecules, that's what's going on with this visceral adiposity. Your fat cells can't store any more fat. You have this leakage of these, you may have this toxic fat spillover into these vital organs that help cause and feed, what Jerry Reaven back in, the 1980s called metabolic syndrome. He just didn't realize that this visceral adiposity, this toxic fat was central in that.
Basically, the engine's not working well. Yeah, you mentioned him in the book. I remember that he had mentioned that back before about the metabolic.
He didn't know. He didn't have the CAT scans that showed the visceral adiposity that was building up. He didn't figure out the obesity part, but he saw this thing called this hyperinsulinemia model. And that's associated with this lipid pattern, right, of non-HDL elevations, hypertriglyceridemia, elevated fasting blood glucose, elevated blood insulin levels.
Right, so too much sugar in your body, too much cholesterol in your body, and all of it, just the whole system starts to not work in a fine-tuned way. if you know, you mentioned a little bit about it's how people respond to food, and some people feel that they're full before others, and so there's a little bit of a component of your own personal makeup. But I'm curious about a little bit also, what do you advise parents who have kids who are exposed to this world of these processed snacks, or in many ways, these dopamine triggers, whether it's not even just processed snacks, it's also screens and many other things. So how would you advise them to manage this for their kids going forward?
I mean, it's very hard. The food environment is structured the way it is. But no doubt this is a lifelong disease. I mean, when we see that diabetic or that person with cardiac disease, I mean, that's the end stage of that. This is lifelong. This is cumulative. These kids are accumulating this visceral adiposity, I mean, over life. Again, we first have to understand, you know, what the problem is, right? And that's where when you see these adolescents and even younger kids with this accumulation of visceral fat, you know, this disease is incubating and is going to, you may not see the cardiac renal consequences yet, but you know that down the road that you.
Right. And we saw, you know, both of us pediatricians, we've seen those kids who were overweight very, very early on. Busy families, two parents working, kids so scheduled in so many activities. How does one realistically keep the nutritious foods in the refrigerator, in the kitchen? And also, how do you pack like a healthy lunch for these kids to achieve the goal of preventing them from ending up with chronic diseases down the road?
Well, you know, the first question is real food? I mean, again, the culprit isn't food, the culprit are these ultra processed foods. I mean, when you look at these foods, if they don't exist in nature, they were obviously, processed. And what the industry learned to do was, I mean, there were certain advantages. I mean, they were shelf stable. They lasted longer. They didn't spoil, but they learned to dial in that fat, sugar, and salt. I mean, it's all about these combinations of fat and sugar, fat and salt, fat, sugar, and salt. So if there's no structure to that food, if it doesn't look like food, if it doesn't occur in nature, right? I mean, chances are, I mean, it's triggering these reward centers of the brain.
So going back to the issue with government, if it's fat, sugar, and salt, what else could the government do to
Howard, hold on a second. Yeah. This is not just about government. I mean, you and I have spent our career in government, but I mean, look at tobacco. It's probably the great public health success.
Yes. Right?
And sure, there were taxes, there were warning statements, you couldn't smoke in secondhand smoke, I mean, on planes, et cetera. And that was always a chipping away. But what did the tobacco, I mean, essentially, though, what the tobacco industry did, right, you know, at the turn of the prior century is they took it was men who smoked, and they, they made tobacco cigarettes into something that was cool, adventuresome, glamorous, you know, sexy, the Marlboro man. It became positively valence. And when you're dealing with an addictive substance, it's something that's psychoactive, right? I mean, when something's positively valence, you want it, you need it, you think it'll make you feel better. And what did we do with tobacco? I mean, sure, again, there were regulations and laws, but we changed how we perceive the value of that tobacco. It was no longer positively valence. We made it out for what it was, a deadly, disgusting, addictive habit. And so there was this critical perceptual shift, I mean, in society, is that those are no longer my friends. We don't need that. And I think we have to start looking at ultra-formulated foods much in the same way.
To tackle this issue.
Correct.
You mentioned, maybe you could share a little bit, you mentioned you took the GLP-1s for a short period of time. What was your experience with that? And then maybe a little bit about you started, you stopped, and then one other part to that question, if you could turn the clock back, what would you have done differently to prevent your own challenges that you faced with all of this?
Yeah, so, I mean, I went on them actually for a number of months. They certainly took me to that edge of nausea, right? I mean, there was a feelings of, you know, bloating and, you know, just, again, not that I was ill by any means, but I clearly perceived that I clearly didn't want to put other stuff into my GI tract. I mean, when we talk about turning down food noise, we're basically saying we're just turning down that cue-induced wanting. I was on these drugs. I lost a significant amount of weight pretty rapidly, I mean, over 6-7 months. But then, you know, I started having certain abdominal pain. You know, GI tract doesn't move as well. We think, you know, there's simple, you know, we think of things like constipation is just, you know, just something we deal with. But constipation, we know if things are not moving in the GI tract, they can sometimes lead to perforation and sepsis and serious complications. So I was having some abdominal pain, and I said, all right, let me try to go if I can go off this. And I went off this, and, you know, but I had to use other tools while I, you know, went off that. And then I've gone back on for periods of time and gone off. So, you know, I've learned to use them, I mean, as one tool. But you got to change how you eat. You got to change your relationship with food. Look, I mean, I used food, you know, to get through. I mean, it's the way I used to stay up, you know, through the night to study, to write, to, you know, get through med school. I mean, to regulate my own emotions, to calm me down, to increase my cognitive attention. There weren't very good tools, I mean, to do that. I mean, my guess is if I were a smoker, I was born 2-3 decades earlier, I would have used tobacco to regulate that. You know, I'm not advocating that. But watch someone picks up a cigarette to change how they feel. I mean, to regulate these subtle ups and downs of daily life. I mean, I was using food in much the same way. Could I have trained myself to emotionally regulate not to use this? Yeah, you know, I mean, I ended up using food. And, you know, for decades, there really have not been effective tools. I mean, the problem with diet, you know, we tell people to, you know, eat less, exercise more. And the fact is that no one can do that. Because you can do it for a certain period of time. You can white knuckle it. You can take that life preserver. You know, you know, when you hold it down on underwater, you can do that for a period of time. But eventually, I mean, it will come back up. There are these opposing forces. So, I mean, of course, if you gain weight, if you have this visceral adiposity, you have to be in an energy deficit state. Sure, you know, the composition of the food is important on the hyperinsulinemia, but you know, the fact is. That you have to eat less, but none of us could do that because of these addictive and metabolic circuits that were in opposing directions. These drugs finally allow you to tamp that down.
Yeah. Back to those late nights in the hospital, right? That was just vending machines. That's what you'd ended up at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, grabbing something which was.
You have this fatigue, and you know you use this to. I thought it would increase, you know, my attention. I was using it for energy, just to increase my cognitive focus. Right? Can I get another 2-3 hours? You know, at 2-3 o'clock in the morning. I mean, so again, I was just using these as drugs to keep me going.
Not easy. Always a challenge there. We want to go to our subscriber questions, but I just wondered if you could share like 3 takeaways. I mean, the book is incredibly thorough, covers so many different issues, but I wonder if there are 3 takeaways that you maybe could share with our audience regarding.
The most important thing is that we can reclaim our health, right? I think we can crack food addiction, and we can use these drugs to change our relationship with food, right? But these are only one tool. They're not a panacea. They're not a cure-all.
Mm-hmm. And any other key things you think, just on the perspective of
you gave me 3. I thought that I do, right?
Oh, well, it's true. That is true. Anything from the standpoint of what you think that should be done. From the standpoint of regulation or or it's really
the give people access to the tools.
Okay.
Right. Provide, you know, I think we, I think that's key, and give people good care. Look, this subject is so hard to talk about. I mean, weight has been so fraught. I mean, there's such stigma, there's such shame attached to it. And for, you know, because nothing worked in the past, we, you know, we decided to, I mean, in essence, some people just said, all right, let's forget about it. Just have, you know, let's celebrate body positivity at any size. The hard part with that is that there are these real health consequences to that. So how do we talk about that? Letting people reclaim their health, but not adding to that shame or stigma. And I think when you realize it's not willpower, I mean, it's really this toxic fat, and it's there are both metabolic and these addictive forces. I mean, we just have to, there should be no shame and no stigma about getting help. I mean, that's the key. You want to talk about personal responsibility? Personal responsibility is go get help. But when you're dealing with these addictive forces, do not think you can deal with this alone by yourself.
And that is a critical issue, to make sure you have sort of a team behind you within your family, your friends, and your doctors and others. We reached the point in our show where I turn to our most important guests, which are our subscribers. So we're going to tee up questions, and I'm sure there are questions for you, David, about this. I always make a key point here that the information we share on the podcast is just for informational purposes, and you really should speak with your doctor because they know your medical history if you have a specific question about...
We're not practicing medicine on the
right, podcast. Right, exactly. That's exactly well said. Thank you. Kat, who should we turn to first? You usually have the first question, Kat, but...
So I'm going to ask the first question, good. And then we have a few questions in the chat. I'll bring those folks up. But I was wondering if there are genetic factors that influence someone's sort of susceptibility to food addiction in some way, shape, or form, if there's any way you could speak to that.
Absolutely. It's not only just food addiction. It's also the metabolic consequences of this ultra-formulated foods. We know there are certainly populations that have high degree of insulin resistance in this toxic fat at sizes, you know, for many, you know, BMI was really adopted back several hundred years. I mean, in a white male population, but you look at, for example, South Asians, they have insulin resistance develop at BMIs of 18, 19, and 20 even. So a BMI of, you know, 23 could be the equivalent of a BMI of 27. That clearly tells you that there are certain genetics at play.
And just a quick thing, what's in the toxic fat? I mean, you mentioned a little bit, is there...
I mean, this is literally free fatty acids that are leaking out, and all these pro-inflammatory cytokines and adipokines, all the interleukin TNF molecules, that the pro-inflammatory. If you look at these GLP-1 drugs and talk to the cardiologist, the thing that they do notice on the GLP-1 drugs is that people's CRP is coming down. That, I mean, that's the inflammatory...
C-reactive protein, an inflammatory marker.
Right? So that's coming down. So in some ways, it's these drugs are shutting down the inflammatory component, and that's coming out of this visceral adiposity that can't hold on to these free fatty acids and other pro-inflammatory molecules.
Thank you so much. Yeah. I'm going to bring up Rick, who has a question for y'all.
First, Howard, thank you again for a fantastic conversation. Dr. Kessler, you have been a hero to me and to a lot of people for many years. So it's a real honor to hear you and to ask a question. So you mentioned a few things about the administration, food dyes, and some of the other comments, but if you were providing guidance and prioritizing action across the executive branch, whether it be around labeling with FDA, research, NIH, CMS efforts, What guidance would you provide, and how would you prioritize?
You're very kind. I mean, what we learned in tobacco is it has to be comprehensive. It's not going to be one single approach. I mean, at FDA, the food label, which we worked on, right, which we did back in the early 1990s, it's become iconic in some ways. I mean, it's great on fat, sugar, and salt, and on calories, but it doesn't tell you the biological effects of what these foods are doing, what the ultra-processed foods, what's the rate of rise of glucose, what its effect on insulin levels. I mean, so just take, you know, what FDA could do, CMS, I mean, can provide access to these drugs, providing you know, the kind of reimbursement so people can get comprehensive care, right? So people will get paid to spend the time to help me reduce this visceral fat. I mean, you need a whole toolkit of regulatory approach, as well as being able to educate the American public and change that perceptual shift of what is the the ultimate problem. I mean, you have one industry making billions of dollars, you know, making us sick. You have another making equal profits to reverse what that former industry does. I mean, if you were from Mars and you came down and looked at that, you would say something's wrong with that. You got to change that that, you know, what's the underlying root cause? I mean, and deal with that. And that's the middle supermarket aisles. But again, it's just not processing. I mean, I can make some of this ultra formulated foods in my house, right? And accumulate this visceral adiposity. So again, you got to clearly identify the problem.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great question, Rick.
Thanks, Rick. Yeah. So I'm going to bring up Ms. Ronnie. She has a question for you.
Hi, Dr. Kessler. Hi, Dr. Zucker.
Hi, Ronnie. How are you?
Good. I wanted to obviously thank Dr. Kessler for his service at the FDA, because those food labels, though they need, you know, to be maybe modified at this point, given your research and everything you're saying, I do find them incredibly helpful. And I see a lot of people in the grocery stores looking at them all the time. So you really did change behaviors in a lot of ways. And yes, the packaged food industry has hijacked our diets, but hopefully all of this conversation can raise the awareness and we can make changes the way you did with tobacco. And I'm really grateful for your work in that area as well. My question is, you know, I'm very conscious of what I eat, but, you know, there are foods that spike the glycemic index, and like, for example, fruit. And, you know, I always thought that we could eat fruit because fruit was really healthy for you and it's natural sugar and it's not additive sugar, and yet it spikes your glycemic index. So how do you feel about that? And how much fruit should we eat, et cetera?
Yeah. So, I mean, you're very right to focus on what the effect of these things are on our bodies. And we have to understand there's great variability, right, between individuals. I am very concerned. You talk about the glucose, but I think it's also that hyperinsulinemia that results to keep that glucose under control. You see your glucose spiking, but I can tell you that glucose is, I mean, it's the elevations in insulin levels that because that glucose is going up, that's trying to keep those glucose levels down, and it's that hyperinsulinemic state, right?
Can you explain that to people? Because I don't think they understand what that means.
So you have glucose rising because there's rapidly absorbable glucose, literally being taken in into the bloodstream, because this flour, you know, much of this flour, this starch that's used in ultra-processed foods, I mean, some of it's in overt sugars and fructose, but some of it is just in flour and starch, is just gets absorbed as glucose, right? You look at your blood glucose and you go, oh, well, that's, I mean, yeah, maybe it's an increase. Insulin, but because we have so much glucose pouring in, insulin's working harder to deal with regulating that glucose level. So you may not even see your glucose going up. But docs tend not to measure insulin levels. I mean, it's a little harder, right? I mean, to do that. But that constant elevation of hyperinsulinemia, right, feeds into this cycle, I mean, and causes this insulin resistance. Is it the insulin resistance which comes first, right? But it all leads to this pro-inflammatory milieu. And the fact is, you know, for some people, it's not going to make a difference if they eat fruit. I mean, they're not hyperinsulinemic to begin with. They're not susceptible to that insulin resistance. Add that fruit onto somebody who is in a hyperinsulinemic, insulin-resistant state. And, it can cause, you know, it could be adding more fuel to the fire. Look, it depends on the fruit. And it depends on what that you know, how much additional glucose and what that rate of rise into the bloodstream is. So it depends. Am I insulin resistant? Do I have a problem with this? I think if you can get that visceral adiposity down, get that visceral adiposity down, get that insulin resistance to become more insulin sensitive. I mean, if you could use these tools to do that, if you can get reclaim your health a little, and then you can get back into this balance where, you know, some of that fruit, I mean, is fine, but you're not adding fuel just to this already, you know, this baseline of where I'm hyperinsulinemic and I'm getting caught further into this vicious cycle. I know that's complex science and in medicine, and we're still figuring it out, but some of us can handle it, some of us can't. And I think the problem with the dietary guidelines is they were written for a healthy body. And the fact is, majority of us are not healthy. Majority of us are insulin resistant. And for those who are insulin resistant, you know, some of these foods are deadly.
So you're challenging, basically you're challenging the system. And you're asking your body to take the sugar there, put it in the right place where it needs to go. But at some point, the system can't keep doing that. And it's just basically getting overworked. And what we're measuring.
And insulin's becoming working harder. Your pancreas is working harder and harder, releasing that insulin to deal with that glucose, right? You're not even measuring your insulin levels. But we've seen a doubling of hyperinsulinemia in the last two decades.
And the doctor sometimes measures a hemoglobin A1C. Sometimes people talk about that test to see whether...
That's on the glucose side, right?
Right. To just see if you're diabetic, if you're going to end up diabetic at some point.
But you're producing more and more insulin until eventually, in some people, we don't understand this, but it goes back to Kevin's earlier point. In certain people that I pump out more, I'm challenging my body with more and more glucose. My body's pumping out more and more insulin. And in certain people, that insulin just ends up burning out.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, it is it's very complex. The whole body is very complex, and you're asking, you know, the body to do more than sometimes it's able to do.
It was never designed, to handle this metabolically rapidly absorbable stuff. And it's basically a lot of metabolic chaos that we're just overburdening the system. And when we developed these foods, these processed foods, no one asked what the effect was on the body.
And some of these changes are starting very early on. We just don't see it for decades. And then sometimes it's just too late. Kat, other questions?
Yep. I'm going to bring up John, who has a question.
Hi, Dr. Kessler. Thank you very much. you know, long time ago, I was a news executive, and one of the first big events I went to, and I don't even remember what it was, I got to sit next to you, and I thought, wow, this is such a cool job. I get to meet people. So it's good to see you again.
Good to see you.
I have two questions, actually. One is just, I wonder whether, thinking back on your illustrious career, are there any initiatives that you wish you had undertaken or had the bandwidth to undertake, or that you regret having done, looking back?
Yeah. Look, no doubt the tobacco effort, right? The investigation of tobacco, I think, changed. We added a chapter, but we did the investigation into the industry, the regulation of tobacco. Again, it was a chipping away. That work. COVID was a, very intense period of time, You know, again, 676 million free vaccines developed in record time, delivered to everybody, put on every corner. And yet there's still people look back, and maybe we just have to expect it. There's such controversy associated with it, right? Why such controversy? I mean, associated with something that was so, I mean, so, you know, I mean, it helped us get to the other side. There were a million lives lost. I just think we don't realize the intensity of the period that we went through.
Yeah. My next question is actually for both of you. I wonder if you could talk about the different satisfactions or challenges of treating patients rather than treating populations. You're both accomplished doctors, but you went into public health.
David, you want to start? That's a great question. That's a great question.
Look, I wrote this book. I mean, I wrote, you know, this latest book. I mean, I see it as no different than taking care of patients. I mean, it was not meant to be a policy. I mean, there's some policy. I mean, at the end, I wanted to give people the tools. Most docs, most dietitians, most nutritionists don't have 6-7 hours to educate their patients to have the tools. So, I mean, to me, I mean, my goal in writing this was to give docs and dietitians and nutritionists something that they could refer their patients to, right? I mean, so that they could, because I mean, these being able to reclaim your health, you have the tools, but you have to know how to do it. And again, it's no one and done. So to me, it was very important. You know, Howard's asked me a lot of policy questions, and I'm happy to engage in them, right? But what I care about is giving people the tools, which I see as no different than taking care of individual patients.
I guess, John, I would answer that the difference for me is a little bit about the internal feeling and the external feeling, in the sense that doing policy work, I feel there's an internal sense of knowing that what you're working on today will make a difference next month, next year, or 10 years from now, and you know you're helping the population at large. That's internal sense. Externally, I will give an example. In a couple months from now, I'm going to the wedding of one of my patients who I took care of when she was 4 months old. And there's an external sense of sort of saying, there she is, right there, standing there, walking down the aisle, and knowing that you helped make sure that was going to happen based on something that happened decades before. And that's sort of very obvious and external, and it's an internal feeling as well, but you can see it right in front of you. So I think that's sort of the difference, but I think both of them are extremely valuable, and it makes one feel that you've helped society and the human condition.
Great. Thank you. And thank you both so much for devoting your considerable skills to the public when you could have probably made a ton more money going the other way.
Probably true. Probably true. Kat, who else do we have? Or is that our last question?
I did see a question come in from Ms. Jerry, but I wanted to see if I can get her to ask her question. Otherwise, we can close it out. But I'm not seeing her come up, so it's okay. We can make that the last one.
Well, I will say that there's another, Jerry is a friend of mine. There, back to John's question. So Jerry is someone whose child I took care of and who has a child of her own who I've been meaning to actually get to see one of these days. And so that's another example of that feeling of knowing you've made a difference for people in the world. So, Kat, anything else or should we close out for the day?
All good to wrap up right. For the day.
Great. Thank you. And David, thank you. It's been wonderful to speak with you about the issues of diet, drugs, and dopamine. It's a great book, and I recommend it to all those who read it, not just those who are struggling with weight, just in general. It touches on so many issues. It's a timely subject. The food industry obviously is under the microscope, and we need to figure out how We address the roles they have played in obesity. You know, I want to thank you for all the work you have done, as John has mentioned, on public health in so many areas, tobacco, COVID, obesity, medical education, and your perspective on the FDA and the federal government in general and how the administration, the wheels of administration, obviously, turn. You know, I look forward to further conversations. It would be great to sit down at some point and speak more about this issue, but also other issues, and maybe reminisce a little bit about Hopkins, because education is medical education has really changed. And in fact, it would be good to bring you back on, because you were the dean at two major medical schools in the country, and the whole academic medicine world and how education is being done for doctors in training has really changed. It'd be great to have a conversation about that as well. But that's it for our show. Remember, if you are a Docology subscriber, you can join the show. You just have to click in the link in the bio and sign up at docology.life, because that's where you can get reminders for the next podcast that we have. But tune in next time, because the topic we cover may just save your life. Docology is a production of Hang Media. Our producer is Catherine Warren. Ronnie Selig is editorial advisor. Our creative director is Anna Richard. Janine Wilson of Wilson Media Group handles paid marketing. Our publicists are Leslie Ann Wade and Jerry Caracoli. Theme music was composed by Nick Kitts. Subscribe and join our community at docology.life. Until next time, move, wash your hands, and stay healthy.